Parker passed through the front door and onto the vestibule. He climbed up onto the top of the express car, ran across it, then jumped down onto the tender and moved toward the engine. He saw the engineer with his hand on the throttle and the fireman standing alongside, leaning on his shovel. Neither of them saw Parker.
Hey! Engineer! Stop this train!
The engineer and the fireman didn't hear him, but they heard the gunshots fired into the air, and they looked around in surprise.
I want you to...
Looking up, Parker saw an avalanche of snow cascading down the side of the mountain, started by his own gunfire. Tons of snow swept him from the top of the tender. The snow continued to come down until Parker, the engine, the tender, and most of the baggage car were buried under hundreds of feet of snow. Kelly, Morris, and Compton had braced themselves for the jarring impact and were immediately on their feet.
All right, boys, this is it!
Kelly and the other three advanced toward the seats where Proxmire, Santelli, and Luke were sitting.
Hello, Santelli.
Do not speak to the prisoners.
Proxmire turned away from the window. He was shocked to see a gun was being pointed directly at him.
What a...
Shut up! I'll shoot the next person who makes a sound.
Santelli held his hands up, showing his cuffed wrists.
The deputy has the keys in his jacket pocket.
Morris reached into the dead deputy's jacket pocket to get the keys to the handcuffs and leg shackles. And a moment later, he was free.
What about him?
Morris indicated Luke Chardine.
Should we take off his handcuffs?
No. Just shoot the son of a bitch and be done with it. Better yet, give me a gun. Let me shoot him.
Acting quickly, so quickly that it caught the others by surprise, Luke stood up from his seat and shoved Santelli back into Morris. Luke dashed out the back door. Then he leaped off the vestibule and into a pile of snow that was nearly as high as the rail car itself. He disappeared at once. The three armed men rushed to the back of the car and out onto the vestibule. Kelly fired into the snowbank. More snow came sliding down.
Don't shoot again. If you do, you could bring the whole mountain down on us. Son of a bitch. Where did he go?
It don't really matter much. Hell, it's below zero. He ain't wearing no coat. Like as not, he'll be froze to death in no more than 10 minutes or so. What I'm wondering is, what happened to Parker?
I expect he's up in the engine, keeping the engineer and the fireman covered till we get up there.
So what's the plan now?
We go up to the front of the train.
Yeah, we're gonna unhook the engine and go on down the pass, leaving the rest of the train up here.
Good plan. By the time anyone figures out what happened, we'll be long gone. Come on.
The four men quickly climbed on top of the car. Then they realized the truth of the situation. The engine and tender had all but disappeared in a mound of snow 200 feet high.
What the hell? What happened?
What happened is the mountain collapsed on us. That's what happened. Like I told you, we're trapped here.
Matt was staring out of the window when unexpectedly the rear door opened. Looking toward the door, he saw what appeared to be a snowman standing there. He had to look a second time before he realized that it was Luke Chardine, covered in snow and nearly frozen to death. His hands were still cuffed and his legs chained.
Luke?
Luke moved away from the back door and stumbled on into the car. Without so much as a word to anyone, he moved quickly to the stove and stood there trying to warm himself. Jenny was the next person who recognized the intruder under all the clinging snow.
Luke!
What are you doing in this car? You're getting snow over everything, and you're frightening the people.
I'm sorry, Senator.
Wait a minute. You're one of the prisoners, aren't you? What did you do? Attempt to escape? Answer me. Did you attempt to escape?
Please, Senator, can't you see that he's nearly frozen to death?
He's going to be worse than that when he's returned to custody. I'm going up to the next car right now and tell the deputy that his prisoner is back here. I'll have you returned to his custody.
You can't do that.
And just what is going to keep me from doing it?
You can't do it because Proxmire is dead.
He's dead? Good heavens, man. Did you kill him?
No. There were four men in the car who were in league with Santelli. One of them, I suspect, is responsible for getting the train stopped. The remaining three killed the deputy and then set Santelli free.
And you?
They were going to kill me as well. But I jumped off the train down into a deep snowbank and got away.
I don't believe you.
I believe him.
Yes, I'm sure that someone like you would believe him.
I believe him, too. Hold your hands out, Luke. I'll get these cuffs off of you.
You have a key?
Of sorts.
Matt held up his penknife.
What? What are you doing? Don't you dare set this prisoner free. Why, I'll not allow you to do such a thing.
Luke held his hands out, and opening the penknife, Matt stuck it in where the handcuffs closed, wedging the ratchet down so he could pull the lock arm out. He did the same thing with the other side, then the leg shackles, and within a few moments, Luke was free.
Oh, that's a good trick to know.
What happened, Luke? Why did we stop? Do you know?
Yes, I know. At least, I'm pretty sure I do. The entire front of the train is buried under snow.
What do you mean, buried in snow?
I mean buried. You can't even see the engine or the tender.
Will we be able to dig out?
I don't see how we can. It looks like the entire mountain came down the engine. At least 200 feet of snow, maybe more. More than likely, the engineer and the fireman are dead by now.
Oh, my God! You mean we're trapped here?
Don't listen to a word this man says, Millie. Can't you see he's merely trying to justify his escape? I don't believe we're trapped.
Then why aren't we moving?
I don't know. You'll have to ask the engineer why he stopped.
Purvis stepped out onto the vestibule, then leaned out so he could look forward toward the front. When he came back into the car, there was a look of shock on his face.
It's too dark to tell, but I think Chardine is right. It sort of looks like the whole front of the train is under snow.
Oh, then we are trapped.
I wouldn't worry about it so much. I'm sure they'll send another train up to get us.
At that moment, the porter came into the car, the expression on his face reflecting his concern.
Porter, this man tells me that the front of the train is buried under an avalanche of snow. Is he correct?
Yes, sir, he is. And it's worse than that.
What do you mean it's worse than that? How can it be worse?
This wasn't no accident. And the men that caused it are up there in the dining car right now. They've taken it over.
So they've taken over a car. What good is it going to do them if the train can't move?
Well, sir, that's where all the food is.
If they've got the dining car, that means we're likely to get awful hungry before this is over.
What's your name, Porter?
My name is Julius, sir. Julius Carey.
Julius, you know where the conductor is?
Yes, sir. He's in the car just ahead. His name is Mr. Bailey.
Would you please tell Mr. Bailey to come back here?
I'm just a porter, sir. Now, I can't tell the conductor anything. Now, I can ask, but that don't mean he'll come back here.
Tell him that Senator Daniels has requested his presence.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I can do that.
Julius left the car, then returned a moment later with the conductor.
Senator, Julius said that you wish to speak with me.
Mr. Bailey, I want you to know that I will hold the Denver and Pacific and you personally responsible should I be unable to fulfill my speaking engagement. Furthermore, I will also hold you responsible for any harm that may befall my family.
I'm glad to see that the welfare of your family is almost equal in your concern to your speaking engagement.
Well, of course it is.
Is this why you summoned me back here?
It is indeed.
Senator, I assure you that what happened here was entirely beyond our control and certainly beyond my control.
Really? Are you telling me that you had no idea that the pass could be blocked in with snow?
The latest telegraph information we had indicated that the pass was clear.
Mr. Bailey, I'm glad you came back because I'd like to speak with you as well, but I have no intention of making any accusations.
Thank you, sir. What can I do for you, Mr. Jensen?
Our information is that the engine is completely buried under a lot of snow. We are also led to understand that armed men have freed the prisoner Santelli and are now occupying the dining car.
I'm afraid that is true, sir.
How many are on this train?
When the train left Buena Vista, we had 40 souls on board. That is counting the crew. That is also counting the sheriff and his two prisoners. But the sheriff is dead, and I fear that the engineer and fireman are also dead. I don't know about Fred, Troy, and Pete.
Who are they?
They're the three that work in the dining car. I haven't heard from any of them since the train stopped, and I'm afraid they may be dead as well.
So that leaves 37 people still aboard if the dining car porters are still alive. And we must subtract the five bad guys, which leaves 32. Finally, even if Fred, Troy, and Pete are still alive, they are no doubt being held by Santelli and the others, so we may as well discount them as well, which leaves 29 of us.
That makes it 29-5. We ought to be able to prevail.
You traveling with a gun, Senator?
A gun? No, of course not. What makes you think I would be traveling with a gun?
You can be sure that all five of the men who took this train will have guns. That tilts the odds in their favor.
Yes. Yes, if you put it like that, I suppose I can see what you mean.
Matt took account of the passengers in this car. Jenny McCoy, Luke Chardine, Abner Purvis, Senator Daniels, his wife and daughter, and himself. In addition, the conductor and porter had now come back to this car. That accounted for 9 of the 29.
There are 9 in here and 20 more on the other two cars. Mr. Bailey, do you know how many of the remaining passengers are men and how many are women?
Other than the two women in here, we have 3 more women passengers. There are also 6 more children, 4 girls, the oldest about 11, and 2 boys, the oldest boy about 9. The youngest of the children is about 5.
Even as Matt and the others were discussing the situation, 5 of the remaining male passengers were making plans of their own in another car. Leading the discussion was Paul Clark, who was a deputy city marshal from Red Cliff.
I know these kind of men. I deal with them all the time. Basically, they're cowards and they get their way by bluff. If we go into the dining car armed, like as not, they won't even put up a fight. And if they do, we'll have the advantage of surprise.
Dennis Dace was the first to speak up.
You can count on me. I was a sergeant in the army. I fought Indians from Wyoming to the Dakotas.
The other 3 men nodded, agreeing to be part of the team.
All right, let's go.
Clark looked back over the car at the other passengers, who were looking on with obvious anxiousness.
You folks, I think you best go back to the next car. You'll be in less danger back there.
The passengers left the car. When the car was clear, Clark and Dace led the other 3 men out onto the vestibule between the passenger car and the dining car. Signaling them to stay low, Clark raised up to look in through the door window. The car was well lit inside, and he saw the 4 armed men sitting at one of the tables drinking coffee. The 3 dining car workers, easily identified because they were wearing white, were sitting at a table between the 4 armed men and the front of the train. Because the front of the train was under snow, there was nowhere for them to go, so they were effectively being held prisoners.
All right. They're all sitting at a table at the other end of the car. None of them will be expecting us, so that gives us the advantage. Are you ready?
We're ready.
Let's go!
Pushing the door open, Clark led the rush into the dining car.
Here they come!
Santelli's yell alerted the 3 other men, and all 4 turned their guns toward the men coming in through the door. Clark went down first, then Patterson, then Dace. The last 2 men, who had barely even made it into the car, withdrew quickly when they realized that the attack had failed.
Get them!
No, let them go! They can't do anything!
What's that?
They felt the train shaking as snow came down on the dining car.
We better be careful about any more shooting. I think that's what's causing all the snow to come down.
Well, tell me, Santelli, how are we going to get out of here?
What do you mean, Kelly?
We were supposed to disconnect the engine from the rest of the train and take it on down the other side of the pass. We sure can't do it now, can we? I mean, what with the engine under all that snow?
We're all right here. We'll just wait it out.
Oh, now how are we going to do that?
Easy. We've got food. They don't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Oh, we do have food, don't we?
But how long will it last?
Quite a while, Morris. You know there's enough food to feed 30 or more people, and they always pack a bit extra. But there's only 4 of us that'll be eating on it. Yes, sir, we're in fine shape.
What about the 3 men we just killed?
What about them?
I don't care to stay in this car with 3 dead men.
That's no problem. Just push them off. The cold won't bother them none.
Back in the rear car, Matt learned of the aborted attack from one of the participants, a man named Turner.
There were 3 of us that got themselves killed.
Turner had been shot in his left arm, and it was being attended to by Jenny, who had tied a bandage around the entry and exit wounds of the bullet.
Clark, he was the first one to go down. He was the one that talked the rest of us into doing it. Then Pace, he went down, and after him, Patterson got killed. Me and Simpson was still out on the vestibule. Hadn't barely made it in yet. When them other 3 got shot, well, we turned and run off.
Was Simpson hit?
No. He was just scared as all. I was too, to tell the truth.
Well, there's certainly no need for shame. For you men to try and rescue the rest of us was a noble and brave thing.
Might have been noble and brave, but it wasn't very smart, Senator.
What do you mean it wasn't very smart? What is your proposal? That we just sit here and do nothing while we starve to death?
I propose that as much as possible, we do not shoot a gun or incite them into shooting one. Any more shooting, and the entire train could be buried under hundreds of feet of snow.
Heavens! Oh, we certainly don't want that.
Well, what do you propose that we do?
I think we should just sit tight. When our train doesn't reach the station in Big Rock, they'll telegraph back to Buena Vista, and they'll send another train after us.
Yes, I suppose that is true, isn't it? Unless...
Unless what?
Well, if the pass is buried under hundreds of feet of snow, then the telegraph poles will be as well. They won't be able to get a telegram through. How will anyone know of our plight?
That's not a problem.
What do you mean it isn't a problem, Mr. Bailey?
We're used to lines being down for one reason or another. If they can't send a telegram directly through the pass to Buena Vista, then they'll send it where the wires are up. The telegram will be sent from station to station, going all the way around the pass, perhaps even to as far as New York and back.
To New York? Oh, my. If it has to go that far, it will take so long that they'll never know about us.
Well, how long do you think it takes to get a telegram signal to New York?
I don't know.
As fast as you can blink an eye.
He's right, Mrs. Daniels. It doesn't make any difference how far away it is. The telegraph signals get there instantly. Why, they even have a telegraph cable that comes from London all the way to New York. Then by telegraph wire across the United States to San Francisco. And it's so fast that a message from London can reach San Francisco before they even send it.
What?
Well, maybe I'm joking with you just a little. But you needn't worry if the telegraph has to go other places before it reaches Buena Vista. Believe me, that won't slow it down.
Oh, well then. We have nothing to worry about then. Do we?
Nothing at all, my dear.
Big Rock, Tuesday, December 20th, 1892. Duff and Smoke reached the depot at a little before 6 o'clock a.m., then went inside to warm themselves as they waited for the train. Phil Wilson, the station agent, saw him coming in.
Smoke! Are you here to catch the train?
Hi, Phil. No, I'm here to meet a friend who's going to spend Christmas with Sally and me.
Well, I hope it gets through.
Yeah, why do you say that? Have you heard something?
No, I haven't heard anything. It's just that if it snowed that hard here, what must it have done to the pass?
Why don't you send a telegram to Buena Vista and see if they have anything to report?
Yeah, well, I was going to wait until 6:30, and if the train didn't arrive, contact them then. Oh, well, but there's really no sense in waiting, is there?
Smoke and Duff followed Phil back to the corner where the telegrapher had his office.
Johnny, contact Buena Vista for me, would you? See if they have any information on the train.
Johnny nodded, then reached out to the telegraph key.
I'm not getting a response. Their line must be out.
Can you go around?
Yes, I can go south to Del Norte and then go through Pueblo. Pueblo should be able to reach Buena Vista. It'll take a moment for them to forward the message on. I made some coffee if you fellas would like some.
They were drinking coffee when a few minutes later the telegraph instrument started clacking.
Well, the train left the station at Buena Vista on time last night. Hasn't returned to the station and we have no further word.
How do you interpret that, Phil?
Well, if it didn't return, then I think it's probably still en route. But even if the snow didn't close the pass, there's no doubt that it would slow it down quite a bit. I suspect they're still on the way, just that it's coming very, very slow. I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't get here until sometime around noon, maybe even later than that.
All right, we'll wait for it.
Where will you be if I get any further word?
We'll be in Longmont Saloon. Oh, Phil, is it all right if I leave the team and Slate here for a while?
Certainly it's all right. Tell Lewis I said hello.
Will do.
Longmont's was truly one of the nicest establishments of its kind that Duff had ever seen in America. And the place would have been at home in San Francisco, St. Louis, or New York. At this hour of the morning, there was no one in the saloon but Lewis Longmont. He was sitting at his usual table in a corner.
Smoke, good morning. I see you brought Duff with you. What are you doing here so early? Not that I'm not pleased to see you, just a little surprised is all, especially on a day like today.
We're meeting the Red Cliff Special.
Really? You mean with all the snow we had last night, there'll be a morning train?
Yes. Well, that is the question, isn't it? We were just over at the depot, and as far as we know, it's still on the way.
My cook's on duty if you'd like some breakfast.
Well, yeah. That's why we came in here. You didn't think we were going to start drinking this early, did you?
And here I thought you came in here out of genuine friendship, just to visit me.
Did the cook make any biscuits this morning?
Of course he did. Can you really have breakfast without biscuits?
Back on the train, Matt had slept fitfully during the remainder of the cold night, but he had fallen into a more sound sleep just before dawn. The sun streaming in through the window awakened him, and he sat up, rubbed his eyes, and looked around the car. Luke Chardine and Jenny McCoy were on the front seat, both asleep and cuddled together for warmth. Becky was asleep under Matt's coat, her head on her mother's lap. Senator Daniels was in the facing seat across from him. Matt decided to see for himself how badly the front of the train was snowed in. Matt climbed to the top of the train. What he saw was not very reassuring. Looking forward, he could see that the front end of the train disappeared into a huge mountain of snow. Even if the engine had been clear, which it was not, they would not have been able to go forward. And the snow was such that they wouldn't be able to go back down the track either. That also meant, Matt realized, that no rescue train would be able to come for them. They were trapped here. Ordinarily, there wouldn't be that much danger in being stranded on the track. There'd be enough food on board the train that if it were carefully managed, they'd be able to survive for a long time, either until a rescue train reached them or until the snow melted enough that they could proceed. But this was not an ordinary case. It grew too cold for Matt as he stood on top of the car, so he climbed back down and went inside. Once he was back inside the car, he saw that the coal supply for the heating stove was running low, and he realized that they would soon be facing a second danger. They would soon run out of coal for the two stoves, and when that happened, the temperature in the car would quickly drop below freezing. Matt picked up the coal scuttle that was sitting beside the stove at the rear of the car and carried it up to the front of the car, where he set it beside the other scuttle.
What are you doing?
Well, Mr. Purvis, if we try and keep both stoves going, we're going to run out of coal in no time. I think it might be best if we just keep a fire going in one.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
The nine people remaining in the car moved to the front to take advantage of the heat.
Do you think they'll send someone after us?
I'm sure they will, Mrs. Daniels.
Mr. Bailey took out his pocket watch, opened it, and examined it.
We were due in Big Rock over an hour ago. When they learn back in Pueblo that we haven't made it to Big Rock yet, why, they'll send a relief train after us.
When Smoke and Duff returned to the depot, Smoke saw that Phil was talking to a customer, so he waited before he approached.
Hello, Smoke. I'm afraid there's still no word from the train.
There's no word? That means they haven't gone back to Buena Vista, doesn't it?
Yes. If the train had gone back, we would have been informed by now by telegraph.
So what you're saying is that the train is still up there, possibly trapped in the past so that it can go neither forward or backward.
That's a possibility.
That's not good. If they're up there too long, they'll run out of food, won't they?
I wouldn't worry too much about anything like that happening. A couple of winters ago, we had a train that got snowed in up on top of the pass, and it was a week late getting here.
A week without food?
Oh, it wasn't anything all that significant. These trains carry enough food with them so that, by rationing, they could survive for 2 weeks or longer. And within 2 weeks, enough of the snow will be melted that I have no doubt but that this train will be able to proceed, or at worst, be relieved by a rescue train.
All right, Phil. You've been through this before. I guess the best thing Duff and I can do now is go on back out to the ranch and wait it out.
Well, you may as well.
Back on the train, it was late afternoon, and because none of the passengers had had anything to eat, everyone was beginning to get hungry. That was when one of the dining car porters came into the rear car, the car occupied by Matt, Luke, Jenny, Senator Daniels and his family, Abner Purvis, Bailey, the conductor, and Julius, the porter.
Troy, I thought you were trapped in the dining car.
Yes, sir, I was. But the men with guns let me go so I could bring a message.
Well, what's the message?
The men with guns say, send them to Hall, and they let the rest of the folks on the train have some food.
What?
I told you, sir, that's not my words. That's the words of the men with guns.
And that's what they said? Send them the whore and they'll give food to the rest of the passengers?
Yes, sir. That's what they said, all right.
Well, just who is the whore they would be talking about?
I don't know, Mr. Bailey. All I know is what they said.
We all know who the whore is.
Jared!
I'm just saying what everyone else knows. They're talking about you, miss.
Senator Daniels pointed to Jenny.
It's up to you now. You could do something good with your life. If you go to them, we'll all get to eat.
No.
What do you mean, no? Good Lord, woman, it's what you do. It's who you are. Only this time, instead of doing it for money, for yourself, you'll be doing it for others. For my wife and my little girl. It can't have escaped your notice that my daughter is sick. Perhaps all she needs is a little food, and you can make that possible. Is that asking too much? It isn't as if you are the total innocent in such things.
You don't understand. You have the wrong idea about me. I'm not a prostitute, and I've never been a prostitute.
Don't lie to us, woman. I am a sitting state senator, which makes me an officer of the state government. And as an officer of the state government, I am ordering you to go to those men for the good of everyone on the train.
I won't do it.
Oh, yes, you will.
As the senator moved toward her, Luke stood up and stepped in between Daniels and Jenny.
If you so much as touch her, I'll throw you off this train.
What? You, a jailbird, are threatening a state senator?
It's not a threat, Senator. It's a promise.
You, conductor, you're in charge of this train. What are you going to do about this?
Senator, I am clearly not in charge of the train at this moment. It's been taken over by armed brigands.
What? The Denver and Pacific is going to hear about this. We should never have left the station in the first place. Now, we're trapped in the mountains for who knows how long, and armed men, which you allowed to board this train, have taken us all hostage. And you stand by and let this man threaten me, but do nothing about it. Yes, sir, the Denver and Pacific will most assuredly hear about this.
But, Jared, Jared, you're frightening Becky. Please, please calm down.
How can I calm down when our very lives are at stake, and this harlot has the means to save us all?
Senator, even if the girl did go to the dining car, do you think they would let her live?
I don't know, but that's the chances you take when you become a prostitute.
I told you, I am not a prostitute.
Then what are you doing on this train? Can you tell me that? You were run out of town, were you not?
Jenny said nothing.
I thought so.
The senator made a move toward her, but Luke stepped between him again.
Young man, you have just made a huge mistake. Whatever your sentence is, you have just added 15 years to it for striking a government official.
Oh, Luke!
Well, Senator, if I'm going to get 15 years just for hitting you one time, I might as well make it worth my while. If you don't go back to your seat, sit down and shut up, I'll beat you within an inch of your life.
What?
Jared, for heaven's sake, get back over here and sit down.
Senator Daniels neither made a move toward Luke and Jenny, nor did he speak again. Instead, he acquiesced to his wife's demand and returned to his seat.
Troy, you can go back and tell the gentlemen who have taken this train that the young lady will not be joining them.
Yes, sir. That's exactly what I would tell them if I was going to go back to the dining car, but I ain't going back.
What do you mean you aren't going back? Good Lord, man, don't you understand the situation? We have no food here. All the food is in the diner. At least you would get to eat.
No, sir. It wouldn't do me no good to go back. The men with the guns, they have themselves a fine breakfast and a fine lunch. But me and Fred and Pete, we didn't have nothing to eat at all. And if it's all the same to you, I won't be going back.
All right. You can stay here in the car with us.
Mr. Bailey, you may have noticed that he and the porter are colored.
Bailey made an exaggerated point of looking at Julius and Troy. Then he melodramatically hit his forehead with the palm of his hand.
By golly, Senator, now that I look at them, I believe you are right. They are colored.
Are you ridiculing me?
No, Senator, you're ridiculing yourself. Of course I know they're colored. What's your point?
My point is, they can't stay here in the car with us.
Well, just where do you think the porters stay when the train is underway?
I don't know. I never see them until I need something done, and then they just sort of appear. I'm just saying that it doesn't seem right that they would be in the same car with us. Oh, but I suppose if they stay to the back of the car, it would be all right.
The back of the car is going to get pretty cold. With only one stove going now, just the front half of the car will be heated. These two men will stay in front of the car with us.
Senator Daniels glared at Matt. Then he sat back down.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. And thank you, sir, for speaking up for us.
It's only common decency. No thanks are needed.
Don and Beans, the train's engineer and fireman, had been trapped inside the engine of the train when the avalanche had come down. They had been working to dig themselves out ever since the train had come to a stop.
We ain't getting nowhere.
Beans sat down on the floor of the engine.
I know we've dug a tunnel 40 feet long or longer. And all I see is snow and more snow. Besides, working this hard, we're just breathing harder and using up more air.
We don't have any choice, but we have to keep digging no matter how far we have to go. If we don't get from under all this snow, we'll eventually run out of air.
Well, you're right there, but I tell you true, I don't see how we're going to do it.
Whoa. I just thought of this. Now, we're digging in the wrong direction. We need to dig down to the ground.
Why? What good would that do us? That'd just put us under more snow, wouldn't it?
Not if we get under the train. Now, we'll go down to the ground, then crawl under the train all the way back.
What if the whole train is under snow?
We'll just pray that it isn't.
For most of the day, one stove had kept the front part of the car bearable, if not comfortable. But by nightfall, it became much colder in the car, so cold that sheets of ice covered the inside windows. The situation was made worse by the fact that they were now forced to use as little coal as possible in order to save fuel.
The irony is that there's enough fuel in the tender to keep every stove on the train going until summer.
But you can't get to it. The engine, tender, and the baggage car are all three under a pile of snow as high as a mountain.
We've got to do something, or it's going to get very cold after a while.
Suddenly, the back door opened and two men came in. As Luke had been earlier, the two men were covered with snow.
Don! Beans!
Bailey went to the two men and embraced them happily.
The engineer and the fireman, they ain't dead!
Don told the others about the man who had attempted to stop the train and how, shooting the gun, he had brought the avalanche down on the train. The others shared with the fireman and engineer the current predicament, how four armed men were holding the entire train hostage by occupying the dining car and commandeering the only food.
Who are these men anyway? Why did they stop a train?
Luke explained that it had all been planned as a means of freeing Michael Santelli.
But it backfired on them.
Actually, it backfired on all of us.
You know, in a way, I'm almost glad this happened.
What? What do you mean you're glad this happened?
Oh, I didn't say I was glad. I said I was almost glad.
Why?
Tell me, Beans. When we're up there in the engine driving the train, do you ever think about the people we're hauling around the country?
Think about them?
Well, yeah, you know, wonder about them.
I don't know as I've thought about them. Mostly the only thing I think about is keeping the steam up.
Well, I think about things like that, too. But I'm always wondering about who's back here and where are they going? Are we taking some soldier boy home to see his mama and daddy for the first time since he left home? Or maybe some young woman who's going to meet a man that's going to be a husband?
Or maybe some folks going to see their grandbaby for the first time.
See, you do wonder about the people we carry.
Nah, I reckon I do. It's just not something I think about very much.
So here we are, sitting back here with them. I've been driving a train now for over 20 years, and this is the first time I ever got to actually meet any of them.
So, what do you think, Don? I mean, now that you've met some of the people.
Some of them I like.
Don glanced over towards Senator Daniels.
And some of them I don't.
But the little girl is sweet. Bless her heart. I hope she gets better.
I'm surprised they haven't sent a rescue train after us. Come 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, we'll be 24 hours overdue.
What do you bet Doodle will be the engineer?
Oh, yeah. Doodle would love to be the one to come to the rescue. And to tell the truth, I'd love to see him pulling up behind us right now. For all that'll give him a head bigger than a watermelon.
As the sun got lower that evening, the temperature in the car got cooler. And Matt wondered how he and the others who had no coats were going to get through the night. Then he looked down at the aisle for a second, his eyes following it all the way to the back of the car.
Luke, got an idea.
Luke, who'd been sitting with Jenny, came over to him.
I hope it's a good one.
Yeah, so do I.
Matt took out his penknife, opened it, then walked up to the front of the aisle and squatted down. He made a slice across the aisle carpet and pulled up the end.
Help me pull up this carpet. We can make serapes out of it.
Yes. Yeah, that is a good idea. What? Yeah, what are you doing? You can't do that. That carpet belongs to the Denver and Pacific.
We'll give it back when we're through with it.
Matt and Luke continued to pull up the carpet. When it was fully taken up, Matt cut it into 10-foot long sections. Then he cut a hole in the middle of each section for a head to stick through. The carpet was 40 feet long. That was long enough to make four serapes. He put his on first to demonstrate how to use it. Then he gave one each to Luke, Julius, and Troy, as the two porters were also without a coat. After a bit of good-natured teasing about how they looked, Matt walked over to the seat where the little girl was lying with her head on her mother's lap.
How's Becky doing?
Oh, Mr. Jensen, I'm so sorry you have to wear that.
Don't worry about it. Keeps me warm enough. Just hope your daughter doesn't get too cold.
Oh, I think that with your coat, she's warm enough. And in a way, I'm almost thankful that she isn't feeling well. She has no appetite, so she isn't suffering from hunger the way the rest of us are.
Sure won't be too much longer before they send a relief train after us.
Yes, I'm sure you're right.
Sugarloaf Ranch. That evening, Smoke, Duff, and Sally were sitting in the keeping room, drinking coffee, looking out at the snow-covered ground, and basking in the warmth of the fireplace.
Tell me, Duff, how did you fare during the Great Die-Up?
The question referred to the winter of 1887-1888, when an enormous blizzard resulted in the death of almost half the cattle in the Northwest.
I've got a natural shelter on my place, and I had enough hay stored, so that for the most part I came through it without too much difficulty. But some of the English ranchers didn't fare so well. It completely broke Moreton Fruin. How did you do?
I had been through a few killing blizzards before, so I was ready for it as well. I've got enough hay laid by now that if this condition lasts, I'll be able to feed my stock.
That's smart of you. On the day after the storm, I rode out with a neighboring rancher to cut his fences so his cattle could drift on the shelter. We found hundreds of them frozen to death, others where their towels had cracked and broken off like icicles. Oh, I don't think I'd ever seen a sadder sight, or heard a more heart-rending sound than the moaning of cattle that were freezing to death. And with the ice and snow so deep, they couldn't get the food, so those that didn't die of starvation froze to death. All we could do was to cut the fences and let them drift, for if they stayed in place, they would have died. And later, when the snow is gone, you could ride for miles and not get away from the sickening sight of dead cows.
Heavens, it's nearly Christmas. Can't we talk about something more pleasant? Duff, tell us about Christmas in Scotland.
Oh, 'twas a fine time we had in Scotland. I remember that my mither used to make a black bun cake.
Oh, what is it? Maybe I could make one.
Nay, for you have to prepare for it. Gather a lot of fruit. The cake is filled with fruit of all kind, almonds, spices, and being as we're Scottish, it had to have plenty of whiskey. It was quite a delight to eat.
What other traditions do you have, other than food?
We had the night of candles. We would put candles in every window to light the way for the Holy Family on Christmas Eve. But there was one custom that's for the rancher.
You have a Christmas custom just for the rancher?
Aye, 'tis called the Christmas Bowl. What it is, you see, is a cloud in the shape of a bull that crosses the sky early on Christmas morning. If the bull is going east, 'twould be a good year. If it's going west, 'twould be a bad year.
On Christmas morning, we'll have to remember to look for the bull in the sky.
If we'll even be able to see the sky on Christmas morning.
Aye, that's the question, for it has been an evil sky for some days now.
I wonder where Matt will be Christmas morning. With us, or will he still be on that train?
Well, either way, he'll be all right. He's on a train, after all, not stranded in the mountains. It may not be his most pleasant Christmas, but at least he'll be warm and well-fed.
During the long, dark night, Luke and Jenny found a way to deal with the cold. Jenny took off her coat and, opening it up, spread it across the two of them like a blanket. Luke did the same thing with his serape, and the two snuggled together. Jenny wasn't sure when it happened, but the embrace grew beyond one of warmth and comfort. She was aware of his muscular body against hers, and she leaned into him, enjoying the contact. They stayed that way for a long moment. Then Luke turned toward her. She could see his eyes shining in the soft light of the dimmed lanterns. Jenny was not surprised when he kissed her, but she was surprised by her reaction to it. She felt a tingling in her lips that spread throughout her body, warming her blood. When they parted, she reached up to touch her lips and held her fingers there for a long moment.
I'm sorry. I had no right to do that.
I'm not sorry.
Jenny, this is doing you a great disservice. I'm going to jail. This isn't going anywhere. It can't possibly go anywhere.
Jenny leaned her head against his shoulder, and he lowered his head so that it rested on hers.
Jenny, have you ever heard of the Samoans?
The Samoans?
No, I don't think so. What are the Samoans?
They are natives to some South Pacific islands. They are a very interesting and friendly people. Wonderfully athletic.
You've been to islands in the South Pacific?
Oh, yes. I've been there many times. And among the Samoan culture, there's a saying that applies to us right now. That is, to you and me. The Samoans say that there is no difference in the heart of a flower that lives but a single day and the heart of a tree that lives for 1,000 years.
That's a beautiful saying.
Do you know what it means?
Yes. For us, it means that we should live in the moment.
Exactly.
Luke leaned in and kissed her again. December 22nd. Santelli, Compton, Morris, and Kelly were enjoying a morning breakfast of bacon and eggs.
What are we going to do, Santelli?
What do you mean, what are we going to do, Compton? We're sitting fine here. We've got all the food we can eat. We're warm and cozy. All we have to do is wait until some of the snow melts.
This here's starting our third day, and we're still here, sitting on this train. And have you seen how much snow is piled up on the engine and tender? There's so much snow there that it ain't likely to melt until August.
It doesn't have to get all the way melted, just enough for us to get out of here. In the meantime, we'll just enjoy our stay. Like I said, with just the four of us, we have enough food to last for a month if need be.
You know damn well the railroad people ain't gonna leave us up here for a month. I wouldn't be surprised if they come here tomorrow.
And how are they gonna get here, Morris?
Why, they'll come up in another train, I reckon.
No, they won't. I climbed up on top of the car to have a look around. Remember, there's damn near as much snow behind us as there is in front of us. Certainly enough to keep any rescue train from making it here for quite a while.
So we're trapped here.
No, we ain't. We're the trappers. The passengers are the trapeze.
Ooh, I wish that whore'd come up here. Hell, if we had her up here, we could have us a fine time just waiting it out.
Oh, she'll come soon.
How you know?
Because she's gonna get damn hungry.
Just then, Kelly saw Fred, one of the porters, with a butter knife in his hand, cutting off a piece of bread at the edge of their table.
Hey!
Fred stopped and started.
Well, that son of a bitch is stealing our food!
Yeah, well, now he's stealing our lead, too.
Fred!
Seeing his friends slaughtered in such a brutal fashion, and knowing the men were distracted, Pete surged up from his seat and ran toward the door.
Kill him!
Pete leapt from the vestibule and ran out into the snow.
Damn!
Pueblo, December 22nd. Sheriff McKenzie came through the door of the mortuary and walked up to Joe Ponder, the city undertaker.
You wanted to talk to me, Joe?
Yes, thank you for coming. Sheriff, I just got a couple of bodies in that I think will interest you. You might want to take a look at them before I get them ready to send back to Bent County.
All right.
There were two bodies inside the mortuary, both of them covered by shrouds.
Murder victims?
No, sir, not exactly. Leastwise, I don't think so. According to Nugent, the shotgun guard on the stage, he killed both of them while they were trying to hold up the stage yesterday. The driver backs him up.
Who are they? Do you know?
Well, yes, sir. I know both of them. That's why I come to get you. I think you're going to be mighty interested when you see who they are.
Ponder pulled the shrouds back.
It's Sheriff Farrell.
Yes, and the other fella is his new deputy. His last name is Clayton, but I don't know his first name.
And you say that Nugent killed both of them while they were holding up the stagecoach?
Well, yes, sir. That's what Jake Nugent and Silas Cambridge both say.
Damn. You know what that means? That means that Luke Chardine was more than likely telling the truth. I'll tell Mr. Murchison he'll for sure want to file an appeal. And I'll send a telegram to the sheriff of Eagle County telling him to have Proxmire bring Luke back for the new trial.
Well, after you see what I found, you may not be able to hold a new trial here.
Why not?
Because more than likely, we won't have a judge who can hold the trial.
What are you talking about, Joe?
Well, sir, I found something in Farrell's pocket that you might want to see.
What is it?
Well, I slipped it back in his pocket so you could see where it came from. Seth Campbell was with me, and he'll back me up that it came from Farrell's pocket.
Are you going to tell me, or are you just going to keep gabbing?
Well, I don't have to tell you. I'll show you.
Ponder reached into Farrell's shirt pocket and pulled out a folded piece of paper.
Stagecoach from Wetmore to Yorkville will be carrying $3,000 in cash. After you do the job, I shall expect $1,000 as my cut. Briggs.
Ha! We got him! I thought all along that son of a bitch was crooked!